special word of welcome to our officials from the department, Ambassador Kujo and the DDG Africa Multilateral, and Ms. Mashaba, newly appointed director. The director is for SADC. Honorable members, let me quickly rush through our agenda. We have four apologies. Well, three apologies and one standing apology. it's an apology from Nyami Boy, Nyamezeli Boy. No, I'm coming to the standing one. Honorable Nyamezeli Boy, Mubu, Honorable Skosana, and then the standing apology, that of the Honorable General Olumisa. Well, there is a standing apology. It's been the case for quite some time. In spite of the whip, Honorable Mahal, acutely raising this matter in our budget vote debate, there seems to be no relenting on this one. Okay, honorable members, we have 3 points on our agenda. One is developments regarding regional integration in SADC. The second one is the African diaspora. And the third one is candidatures to the UN and other international organizations. Now, let me just, on point three, make the following announcement. On candidatures, you will understand, colleagues, that you know, because of the sensitive nature of candidatures, especially public discussions and public pronouncements around these issues, the department or the DDG, when she makes the presentation, will not go into the specifics of who has been nominated for what position in which organization, right? The document that you have with names on and positions and so on is for your own consumption, and those documents are regarded as confidential. So please bear with us on that one. We know we've had some of these cases in the past, and some of the people summarily, you know, some of them summarily withdrew and so on and so on. And you know the sensitive nature of negotiations with others, especially other sister countries, around these issues may pose some problems. You will also be with us on the question of the of. You will note in your documents there are countries and so on listed, you know, who are vying for which position and so on. We will also not be given, or announcements will not be made with regard to which country we specifically support at this stage, again because of the sensitivities around that. So please, it will be a broad presentation on, you know, the broad principles informing candidatures and our approach, South Africa and so on, right? So on this one, I want us to get it out of the way. Are we clear? Okay, thank you so much. Now, honourable members, let me hand over to the ambassador, Ambassador Kujo, and Ms. Mashaba, and Mr. Kutsia, to take us through the first presentation on the regional integration within SADC. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We will start with the presentation that is going to focus on the SADC regional integration. In our presentation, we would like to give a little bit of background and the objectives of why we are focusing on regional integration, the challenges that are there in dealing with the issues of regional economic integration, and also what are the areas that we are focusing on that constitute regional integration. One of those ones is the SADC priorities, the Southern African Customs Union, the SADC Free Trade Area, the Regional Indicative Strategic Development Plan, which is derived from NEPAD, and then the COMESA East Africa Community and SADC Tripartite Free Trade Area. And we would like also to touch a little bit in terms of what South Africa's take is on all these issues, and then end up by proposing a way forward. Chairperson, let me just start by saying that, as we all know, that our national priority is education, health, job creation, reduction of crime, as well as rural development. So we think that through regional economic integration, we can focus on the issues of trade, investment, job creation, poverty alleviation, and also to achieve to a great extent issues of peace and security. And we also are of the view that when we have in the region economies that are very diversified, but also economies that are geared towards being competitive globally, then we can be able to create jobs. There is no way that the SADC region can be able to create jobs if our economies are going to be import driven. For us to be able to create jobs, we need to be economies that produce and therefore be able to export. And also, once we create jobs, we begin to address the issues of poverty eradication. Eventually is what we aim for, but I think we start off with alleviating with an intention of completely eradicating poverty. And then we are also guided by the 1996 SADC Protocol, which has resulted in the development of the SADC Free Trade Area. As the members would recall, part of the time frame that we had set for ourselves was that in 2008, SADC must be able to move towards a free trade area. And indeed, in 2008, we were able to do so. And as the members would recall, this was done when South Africa was the chairperson of SADC, and the free trade area was launched in Sandton. And we are also focusing in achieving regional integration, supported by our own trade policy and strategy documents that have been adopted in 2010. You will remember that we have IPAP2, which is the Industrial Policy Action Plan. And I think what is key with the industrial policy plan is that South Africa is aspiring to be a beneficiation capital of the continent, and we hope that in future we will be the beneficiation capital of the world. And that also talks to the regional the mineral resources that we have. If you look at most of the African countries, each one of us has a some raw materials of some sort, and what has been the practice is that all those mineral resources tend to be sold abroad without us adding value. So if we go towards a situation where there is an agreement that a certain percentage of our mineral resources and raw materials should be beneficiated, then we are able to make more money out of that than if we are to export the raw materials as they are. But when we beneficiate as well, we are able to empower our people with their skills development. And then we also have the new growth path, and then the outcomes 11. As the International Relations and Cooperation Department, outcomes 11 speaks directly to what the department is engaged with. And then, of course, I think as South Africa, we are also looking at the cooperation with emerging markets, and I understand that there is somebody from the Russian embassy. So we think that through being in BRICS, one, there are opportunities that exist for us as South Africa, but we also want to create opportunities, one, for SADC region, the region to which we belong, but also seeing how we can take cooperation with the BRICS members into the rest of the African continent. In terms of the objectives, regional integration seeks to contribute towards the improvement of the climate for domestic, cross-border and foreign investment. I think honorable members of the portfolio committee, as you may be aware, right now at the African level, we still stand at 10% in terms of the trade that we conduct amongst ourselves as African countries. So what is clear is that as a continent, we tend to trade more with the outside the continent than we do amongst ourselves. And through regional integration, we hope that the figures can be increased. But also, I also want to mention at this stage that the regional economic communities, of which SADC is one, are used as the building blocks for the African Union. So we need to achieve a lot of regional integration and also intra-REC trade activities. Like, for instance, if SADC will enter into some trade and investment agreements with COMESA and the EAC, as we just did the previous week when we were having the tripartite summit. Secondly, we hope that collectively we can have an approach of how we engage each other as regional economic communities. Thirdly, we want to enhance the economic development, diversification and industrialization of the region. One of the problems we have is that we are not very much industrialized as the region. But besides that, we also do not have the right infrastructure to assist us to be able to trade with each other. And part of those ones I even seen, for instance, if we even have some people that are traveling from our region going to Algeria, for instance, you'll have to go through France before you are able to come back to the African continent to Algeria, which is the final destination where we are going. So all those ones are very critical for us if we are to achieve the objectives of regional integration. We need also to transform the SADC region into a competitive and effective player on the global political and economic stage. Now, in terms of the challenges that we have, is that one, we have lack of commitment in the implementation of targets by member states. As you all know, we are still waiting for the DRC, for Angola, to accede to the SADC free trade area. They have signed, but they have not ratified, and only through ratification can they accede to the free trade area. So we are 15 members, but we still have those countries that are not part of the free trade area. And another challenge is that we have overlapping memberships in the regional economic communities. For instance, Tanzania is the member of SADC, and at the same time, it is the member of the East Africa community. We have Swaziland right now, that is the SADC member state, but at the moment, they are also the chair of the COMESA. So in a community of 15 countries, 8 of those ones have double membership. So to a very large extent, it does hamper the process of moving speedily into an integrated region. Then you also have the problem of the lack of funding for SADC programs, which are financed mainly by donor agencies, which in itself presents the challenges of ownership and foreign influence. What we have done at the SADC level, we tried to isolate the programs that we think should be amenable to international cooperating partners, donorship, but also those ones that we think should not be funded by the donor. But when you also have a problem of member states not being able to pay their membership dues, then you have the problem of ownership. For instance, if we have the European Union that is offering to pay, let me say, for instance, for infrastructure or for any of our regional integration activities, then we have a problem, because such funding will always come with strings attached. So if at member state level we are able to fund all our integration programs, then we think that we will not have problems of ownership, and we will not have problems of foreign influence. And the other thing is that our markets are not quite diversified. For us to be globally competitive, we need to diversify our markets and remain exporters of low-value raw materials and importers of high-value goods. So in order for us to be in a comfortable situation, we need to rather be the exporters of high-value goods and importers of low-value goods. Other challenges that we have is that we don't have infrastructure. For instance, if one wants to export things from South Africa to Zambia, you find that we don't have proper railway system all the way, for instance, to Zambia. So along the way, you see that instead of getting the goods to their final destination very quickly, it takes much longer, because then the infrastructure is not there. The other challenge we have is that in our region, when you look at the countries that are the members, we are all at different levels of economic development. So therefore, it sometimes becomes very difficult to have the same economic policies when all of you are looking for different things in terms of development. And I think a clear example of that is SACCO. If you look at all the other members of SACCO, our levels of development are very different, and therefore what we seek to achieve by being in SACCO is hampered by the very fact that we are all at different levels of development. And then I think within SACCO as well, with the exception of South Africa, most of the countries rely largely on the revenue that we make from SACCO, and they look at that as part of their budget. And I think that explains some of the problems that we're experiencing right now within SACCO. Now, in terms of SADC priorities, it's a development of comprehensive work programs in an effort to consolidate the regional economic integration agenda. We have a regional indicative strategic development plan, which was drawn up in 2000. And when we drew up the RISDP, it was drawn from NEPAD, because NEPAD is the blueprint for socio-economic development of the entire African Union. And member states and regional economic communities, since they are the building blocks of the AU, they need to draw the inspiration from NEPAD to be able to draw up their own socio-economic blueprint program of action. And for SADC, it is the Regional Indicative Strategic Development Plan. Now, as I had mentioned earlier on, the RISDP was drawn in 2000. So we are 11 years down the line with that blueprint. Now, it's important for us to embark upon a review so as to know whether we are doing well, whether there are certain things that we need to give more focus than others. And then once we have been able to conduct the review, we can then determine where we need to put more of our resources. And then the other issue is the one of the consolidation of a SADC free trade area, and also the status of the SADC customs union. Now, I want to take these two issues together. Within a community of 15 members, member states, we have two schools of thought. One is driven by South Africa, where we are saying that we need to consolidate the free trade area. Now, in terms of our own roadmap, we had agreed that in 2008, we will have a SADC free trade area. And then in 2010, we need to move into a customs union. Now, South Africa's position of the consolidation of the free trade area was driven by the fact that if we still have countries like the DRC and Angola that have not actually acceded to the protocol that establishes the free trade area, how do we then move into the customs union? But also you see that within SADC, South Africa alone has a free trade area with the European Union. We then have the Southern African Customs Union. Then out of the 15 member states, we have 12 of those that have signed the economic partnership agreement. And then besides that, then we have SADC. So you see that within a small community of 15 countries, we have more or less six trading regimes, which in itself presents a problem. And the fact that we are all at different levels of development, we have poor infrastructure, we have to deal with the issues of rules of origin, the tariffs, and the rest of the things. We thought that let us focus on the consolidation of the free trade area. Then we can only move into the customs union when we are sure that we have laid the solid foundation for us to be able to move into the customs union, and that we shouldn't be driven by a date that we had agreed upon. Now you have countries like Mozambique, like Botswana and Swaziland that firmly believe that we have set ourselves a time frame of 2010 to move into the customs union. And whether we have the necessary foundation on the ground or not, that we should move into the customs union. And our view was that we need to identify the necessary benchmarks that we will need for us to be able to move into a customs union. And it is only upon achievement of those benchmarks can we then say we are ready and comfortable to move into a customs union. And the week that ended Sunday, we came back from a COMESA EAC SADC tripartite meeting. Mm-hmm. Now, in 2008, we had signed a memorandum of understanding where we were saying that with this memorandum of understanding, we would want to pave way for us to sign a free trade area amongst these three regional economic communities. Let me also say that with these three regional economic communities, they bring together 26 member states, which is basically half of the entire membership of the African Union. But altogether, we are also a population of 700 million. So we thought that it makes sense to actually move into that free trade area, because then we've got a bigger market for our products. Now, going to SACCO, you may all be aware that last year we celebrated the centenary of SACCO. And SACCO was developed during the apartheid years, and the members is South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Namibia. And those countries were picked up because that time, under the apartheid, those countries were seen as the protectorate of South Africa. However, SACCO as a customs union, and the oldest for that matter in the world, has undergone little change. And we felt that the celebration of the centenary provides us with an opportunity to actually review how we want to move with the SACCO. And maybe if we do a good job of it, maybe we can utilize it to be able to use it for the rest of the SADC member states, so that then it is extended to all 15 members as opposed to only the five that we have. But in 2002, we tried to do a little bit of a review, and we have not been able to fully implement whatever was agreed upon. And then, of course, renewal of the SACCO agreement is complicated by the fact that we have economic partnership agreements which, as South Africa, we felt that it was not in the interest of the European Union to sign, but also it was not in the interest of any of the African countries to sign. One, because we have the overlapping membership, but also we will be opening our borders for most of the goods coming from Europe without them having to pay the tariffs. But as well, again, with many of the other countries having gone into signing the economic partnership agreement, we see that this has completely killed the textile industry of South Africa. Because if you also look in terms of the salaries that we pay in our textile industries. And for instance, if you take the countries like Zimbabwe and Lesotho, they would pay about 150 rand per employee per week, and we pay about 740 rand. So therefore, it becomes very difficult for us to compete in an environment like that. But as well, we thought that it's going to complicate us moving into becoming a regionally integrated community. It was complicating our situation, and we think that the objectives of the EPAS are not actually helping us to move speedily into regional integration. But as well, we thought that it is very difficult for us to go into the EPAS without necessarily sorting out how do we deal with the issue that South Africa has a free trade area with the European Union. A country like Namibia had its own concerns, and Angola had its own concerns, that even given the good economic growth that they've been experiencing for a number of years, that they are still classified as the least developed country. So those are the complications that are presented by the EPAS. However, with SACU, we think that there are certain things that we need to do. First of all, we think that we need to review the revenue sharing formula. We need to put proper structures in place. And it is only from last year that a decision was taken that now SACU needs to meet at the head of state level. So for the past 100 years, SACU had never met at the head of state level. And then we also realized that we need to industrialize SACU, but we also need to promote intra-SACU projects. So within SACU, a customs union of 5 members, we are not really doing also quite a good job in terms of doing cross-border projects with regard to trade and investment. And then, like I mentioned, we have a low intra-regional trade, the problem of not diversifying our products. But as well, if you look at the other members, there isn't really so much that they are able to produce. So most of their issues are products are not the ones that will attract a high income. I think I've spoken to that slide. Now, with regard to the SADC Free Trade Area, it was launched in 2008. It provides an enabling platform for us to positively advance higher levels of regional economic integration and infrastructure development. And in the summit of August 2010, we adopted a comprehensive work program with concrete actions and timelines aiming at consolidating the SADC Free Trade Area. And then SADC has a significant trade integration progress recorded that through the free trade area in 2008, we were able to have 85% of the goods that were traded duty-free. And we are expecting that by 2012, the 85% would have increased to 99%, which will be goods that we can trade without attracting any duty. The Regional Indicative Strategic Development Plan was identified and established for specific milestones in support of regional economic integration. For instance, the SADC Free Trade Area was achieved emanating from the RISDP, and like I had mentioned earlier on, we had planned that we will have a customs union by 2010, but we felt that the environment was not conducive for us to move into a customs union. And we are hoping that in 2016, we will be able to move in a monetary union. Let me just state that this is a roadmap that SADC had. But for us to be able to even go into a monetary union, it depends on the progress that we'll be able to make on the ground. If we are not able to move into a customs union by then, the question would be, would we then be able to actually have a monetary union by 2016. Now, focusing on the recent developments, in March we had a Council of Ministers that took place in Windhoek, and it was agreed that as member states we need to look at the review of the National Development Plan aligned with the RISDP. What we are going to be doing now is that the SADC Secretariat is conducting a desk evaluation of the RISDP. Basically, what that means is that they've drawn up questionnaires that have been forwarded to member states that cover the entire issues that are covered by our indicative program. And once we receive the response from that, then they will draw up the terms of reference, which will then inform the comprehensive review of the regional indicative strategic development plan. And then once we have drawn up the terms of reference, we will commission a study that will be comprehensive and through which we will know how we are doing as a region in terms of delivering on our priorities. And we are hoping that when we go to the August summit, where Angola will take over the chair of SADC from Namibia, we'll be able to receive progress in terms of how far we have come in looking at the review of the RISDP. COMESA, EAC, and SADC Tripartite Free Trade Area, as I had mentioned earlier on, that this is a community that brings, this is a corporation that brings together 26 member states with a population of plus minus 600 million, with a total gross domestic product of approximately $1 trillion US dollars. And it is anticipated that by 2015 we may be at $2 trillion in terms of our gross domestic product. We think that it is a very good idea. Already right now, the ministers of trade and industry are focusing on the key elements of the free trade area. One, we have agreed that we need to focus on the North-South corridor, which has to do with infrastructure development. But two, we need to look at the issues of industrial development. And then thirdly, we think that we need to be focusing on the free movement of people. Because if we are to do business, we need to put the legislation in place that will allow free movement of the business people. However, whilst we are dealing with the tripartite free trade area, we need to address the issue of overlapping membership. We also need to look at the forms of a building block towards an eventual African economic integration as envisaged by the Abuja Treaty of the African Union. And we think this will provide an opportunity to better expand market access for South African products, but also for other SADC countries on the continent, while preserving our own program of trade that we want to pursue. Officially, the FTA is going to be was launched on the 12th of June, that is the past Sunday, in Joburg, and it endorsed the three pillars, which is market integration, infrastructure development, and industrial development. And summit also endorsed that the tripartite free trade area negotiating principles and processes of institutional framework, and that most of the principles agreed to were that the negotiations shall be driven by the REC. The EAC says that they prefer to be addressed as a grouping, which is a REC of five member states, and that it is very important that such a free trade area must be driven by member states and not the secretariat of the three regional economic communities, and that we need to also look at the principle of variable geometry. And that is necessitated by the fact that all of us have different level of economic development. Some countries may come into it at a later stage when they feel they are ready to move in, but also certain regional economic communities have not gotten to a stage where they are ready to go into the free trade area right away. So that's why we thought that the principle of variable geometry will be useful for all member states to move into it as and when they are ready. We now have also a tripartite area, a roadmap for negotiations, and that the preparatory phase that the Ministers of Trade and Industry will look at is between 6 and 12 months, which will be phase one for negotiations on trade. And we hope that in 3 years' time, we would have finished the negotiation. And phase two will be for negotiations under the built-in agenda to be undertaken after the completion of phase one. That will look at the services sector, the intellectual property, and other trade-related issues. Summit has agreed that we need to give priority to the negotiations on the movement of business persons as well as the work programs on infrastructure and industrial development, which will be undertaken concurrently and not on separate tracks during phase one. And Summit also noted that the time frames may run concurrently rather than sequentially on the basis that some programs would be ongoing and could therefore be pursued simultaneously. Now, in terms of South Africa's approach to regional economic community, we think that it is important in advancing a developmental integration agenda that combines both trade integration, infrastructure development, and sector policy coordination, which will allow us to move towards productive capacity across the region. We also feel that we need to support the need to accelerate regional economic integration and endorse SADC roadmap for achievement of the objectives as we have spelled out for ourselves as a region. South Africa is advancing a development integration agenda in Southern Africa that combines trade integration, infrastructure development, and sector policy coordination in supporting the building of greater productive capacity across the region. This will include the strengthening of a real economic cooperation agenda, of which industrial development is a critical component. And the process, we feel, is hampered by a lack of commitment by member states, and that we should not be shifting goalposts, and we need to also have greater cohesion in our efforts towards realizing the objectives of this agenda. Regional integration and regional and continental infrastructure development is very key and important in the realization of Africa's economic growth and the development of imperatives and ambitions for greater trade integration and global market access. As you will be aware, last year in Uganda, the president also proposed an infrastructure project that was hinging on 5 pillars. One of that is rail and road infrastructure development, energy development, ICT, water, and agriculture. And each one of these sectors will be championed by a head of state. And our president offered to champion the North-South Corridor project, which actually straddles SADC, COMESA, EAC, the three RECs that are coming together to form a tripartite. And it was also with the belief that when we focus on those five areas, we will have greater economic development in those areas, but there will also be an increase of economic activities, and through those ones, it will be easy as well for us to be able to create jobs. And then we also feel that without the elements of infrastructure and industrialization, it will be difficult for SADC countries and other African countries to grow and develop into a productive and manufacturing capacity economies, which will really be needed to export to other fellow African countries, meaning that we need, if we focus on those ones, we can begin to increase the level of intra-African trade, and that the emerging economies of the South and indeed those ones of the world can benefit from us having a proper infrastructure in place. The primary challenge for Africa in relation to enhancing its trade capacity is to gain access to the value chains found in the South-South cooperation as well as North-South linkages that we have. In terms of the way forward, Chairperson, in order to finalize the review of the RISDP priority and time frame, we need, one, to consolidate the FTA. We need to promote and strengthen the institutional cooperation between SADC and SACU, and the notion of SACU being the nucleus for regional economic integration. We need to prioritize regional economic integration with focus on market integration, infrastructure development, and industrial development. And we need to ensure that the realization of the grant free trade area is achieved as quickly as possible. South Africa needs to develop mechanisms to be more assertive as a key role player in the region, the continent, and beyond, and that there is a need for us to develop clear strategies of engagement within various groupings and to ensure that these strategies are in line with our interests as a country and the region. For instance, how are we going to better utilize our membership of the BRICS that we need to manage carefully, but also be mindful of the fact that BRICS members are also competing for the same market that we want as South Africa, which is the African continent. I thank you, Chairperson. That concludes my presentation on the regional integration.
thank you so much, Ambassador Kujo, for this comprehensive presentation. Now, normally our esteemed colleagues from the opposition laugh at us, especially us from the ruling party, when we say thank you, Minister, for your comprehensive presentation.
The way you say it.
Oh, it's about the way you say it.
In the sixth
sense, you can
say
it. Yeah, thank you so much. in the Western Cape legislature. Yeah. Yeah, it's a knife, it cuts both ways. Yeah. No, thank you so much, Ambassador. Now, let me first acknowledge, I wasn't aware that we have somebody from the Russian embassy. Let me acknowledge Mr. Andrei Borovik, attaché from the Consulate General of the Russian Federation. He is based in Cape Town. Welcome, sir. Thank you. The honourable members, let's engage with the presentation. Perhaps just to say, Ambassador, that as a committee, we are quite seized with this matter. To us, a matter of extreme importance. For obvious reasons, our most important program, the advancement of the African agenda, as we understand it correctly, places emphasis on the building of these RECs, as a cornerstone for the development and integration of Africa. And as such, if these RECs experience the kind of challenges that ours experience as SADC, for instance. We have seen in other RECs, some of conflicting messages, especially insofar as political matters are concerned. The kind of divergent views on issues that we fundamentally as Africans, given our experience, we should have broadly agreed on in terms of principles and so on. It becomes a matter that we really should be vexed with. continuously. And so as a committee, this is one of the issues really that we want to focus on. At some point, we are expecting a workshop on challenges on the very same issues. But we will have that engagement with the SADC office, the SADC secretariat. So this will be an ongoing process. So I'm just saying that to us, this is a very important matter, as it is to you as a department. Honorable members, any questions, comments? Honorable Mukhalafa.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for the lack of better words report that you've just given us. I think it's quite extensive, and it gives us a food for thought. But I think Chair have said something up very well, that I think the process is now on us. It's incumbent on us to use our parliamentary diplomacy to influence this in making sure that it becomes a reality. Look, I mean, the bottom line is the principle is sound. We are for regional integration. It should happen. I think there's no question and debate about that. But I see the problem is that we are going in different directions. We don't have cohesion, as you correctly put it here. And the thing is, we got to get the basics right. And that is where the challenge comes in, because of we are pulling in different directions. I mean, your example of Comesa and ECOWAS, it's a classical one. It shows that we are pulling in different directions. And this thing of not acceding to our continental or regional agreement, it's one big problem for us. And I think the problem here is how do we make sure that we garner all those 26 countries, or even let's start with 15, because we're talking of SADC. How do we say to those 15 countries we are moving forward from our historical past? Because I think the problem is the history of the SADC and South Africa's role in the whole thing. Because if you remember, our historical past was based on mistrust and animosity as South Africans. So how do we transcend from that historical past into making sure that the SADC countries understand this project that we want to do? Because I think this is encompassed by the example of the EAPAS. You know, this EAPAS, it's something that is a very classical bona fide thing, that how do we go and negotiate with a global partner on different terms, while we should be going there and as a unit in order to get a better deal. But I think the issue again goes to the issue of different interests. We've got one regional bloc with different interests, and it gives a challenge, because if everybody goes there with their own pro forma interests. So, okay, with saying that, I think that is the thing. And the issue of uneven competition, because I think that is what is happening. When you're referring to low intra-regional trade, I think it's a question of uneven competition. Because every time we negotiate with our regional counterparts, but they say no, but you already, engage with us while you are at an advantage position. And how do we make sure that we transcend in moving forward to make our regional counterparts understand that, we are saying we are taking you on board with what we have. So having said that, I think the issue of regional integration, yes, we must go for it, we must look forward. But it's incumbent on us to make sure. One thing that is good that I hear you saying is that now most of these RSI DPs are now at the level of the heads of state. And officially, I think it's a bonus, because of most of the time has been done in smoke rooms and it doesn't see the light of day. But if the heads of state are champions of this, then at least there is progress. But those heads of state must understand that the three pillars must work: good governance, democracy, you know, and accountability should be the core pillar of them negotiating these things. Because if you cannot negotiate and one country is a model, the other one you are going with crisis management, how do you make sure that regional integration happen if you don't adhere to those common principles? Because of, I believe that, yes, much as we are talking about doing trade internally amongst ourselves, but the grand project of NIPAT was to open the market access of Africa to the world. So, and the world is saying, you must give us good governance, you must give us democracy, you must give us accountability. And how do we make sure that ourselves, as a regional bloc, we adhere to those principles to make sure that our markets are accessible and the FDIs are coming our way and we are attracting investors. And the issue of dual membership, you're talking about overlapping membership. I think it's quite a thorny issue there. Like they say, in international relations, there are no permanent friends. Just permanent interest. So I guess that explains why you've got dual membership and overlapping membership, because people are looking at their interests in this regard. And then finally, when we were talking about the issue of the tripartite summit decision, and you are talking about integration, market integration, infrastructure development, industrial, one critical factor that is being left there is human development. And I believe the founding principle of African Renaissance spoke about human development skills. How do we make sure that in this grand project we capacitate our people to be competitive? And I see that those resolutions doesn't cover that critical factor. But having said that, I think the onus is on us to in Parliament to use our parliamentary diplomacy chair and engage our counterparts to make sure that they understand and they move with speed. But I think it's on the level of the heads of state and maybe from parliament to parliament to influence this thing. But the principle of regional integration, we got to go forward for it. We just got to make sure that the other regional counterparts understand this grand project. Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay. Thank you so much. I had the hand of Honorable Jacobus. Before you proceed, Honorable Jacobus, Honorable Suleiman, can you just quickly assume the chair?
Just want to step up. No, it's fine. You can sit right there. So just sit right there. Just proceed. Yeah.
I completely agree with the chairperson when he said maybe we need a more in-depth kind of workshop type of thing, especially after the meeting of the weekend that took place in Johannesburg, just to give us a better grasp of where we are and where we are going. One of the principles that underpins our foreign policy is the issue of integration. And free movement of people, goods and services, especially in the continent. I'm just wondering, it's a general question, Ambassador, how this will impact, and I know we've got a lot of laws that have unintended consequences, you know, beautiful laws and stuff like that. Even our constitution has some clauses that have unintentional consequences that works against us as a country. The implication thereof, of the importation, because there are, I think you mentioned on slide 10, that by next year, 2012, we're envisaging 99% of goods traded will be duty-free. I'm not sure if we've identified what those goods are or if it's just general goods. I'm asking this because I'm wondering what the implications would be of the importation of all these counterfeit goods. You know, that they're not necessarily grabbed at the airport or ports of entry and stuff like that. They are found in a townhouse in Sandton. Yeah, cigarettes and all sorts of things, and some of them have already found their way into communities and so on. What would be the implication thereof? And similarly, the issue of the free movement of people. You know, we have a particular problem in South Africa where there are a lot of people that are just coming in, you know, for whatever their reasons are. And what would that implication then mean for us as a country? if we're saying, okay, people can just now come in, and for everybody basically, and people come with dubious intentions, not necessarily to come and do business or, you know, stuff like that. As I'm saying, Chairperson, it's a general question. If I could just maybe get a response on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Jacobus. Now, any other members? Honorable member?
Thank you, Chair. Also in support of the committee and considering a broader workshop on this matter, so that we can also make a better contribution towards the process as the parliamentarians in this regard. The first one that I want to address, Chair, is as members of Parliament, I of course we do have a role, but I think maybe what we should do and ask also of the department is one of our core functions are legislation. I think it will be good if we could be afforded an opportunity just to look into the legislation that can enhance regional integration and or the legislation that impede integration, and then find expression through whatever structures. Now, so whether it is in our immediate structures as a parliament in the country, in the region, sort of select, in the IPU, in what else do we have? The other parliament, the African Parliament. I think if we go through because I think we've got to find a way of what contribution we can make, and if eventually if it lands up in the African Parliament, then it's a great stride that we would have been making at Parliament. So that's the first one that I want to say, Chair, that we probably should have another look on. The second one is I think we should find consensus at home. And finding consensus at home, I would imagine that, there's discussions in NEDLAC and so on, and any other similar structures. But Parliament should afford you an opportunity to have public hearings on this matter. And that will also assist bringing consensus in the country on this matter. I'm raising this because I heard your example of the clothing textile issue, which of course the industry that they know very well. You see, we can't be expected to say that the people must now earn 150 rand a week. We should go after those employers that cross the border who are South Africans and that run to Lesotho. And then they go and pay those peanuts to the people there and then expect us to be under pressure as South Africans, whereas it's got to be the other way around that the pressure needs. So I think that's the other area that I wanted to say. We should find consensus at home and look at all the different avenues that you said. The third area is I really appreciate the complexities that you have raised here today, and it's absolutely not... It's not easy. In South Africa, if we try and merge, you can imagine all the pain and hardship that go with that. Now imagine wanting to bring together all these different countries. It can't not be easy and with our past there. So I think, there's some good examples that we can take out of a leaf, that we can take out of the WTO negotiations and look at the difficulties there in just bringing a developmental agenda and bringing it and now not able to implement it. And I think we should maybe just take the Africa part out of the WTO and look at the issues that bring us together or not. And as I end off, I want to say that using the WTO experience is to say, what are the threats that are that hold us together? If the threads that hold us together, is the fact that we have a comparative advantage on a range of different things. Let us use our comparative advantage to start bringing the threads together, and we should be able to, you know, Kumari Mandela once attempted this very noble thing, and he said South Africa can manufacture certain things, but we don't have enough cotton, for example, in the country. And why don't we get, I can't remember which country it was, Tanzania, no, it wasn't Egypt, no, it was another one, Mali or Malawi, one of them, closer to us. Why can't they produce the cotton and we then, you know, we source the cotton from them, their comparative advantage, and we have the skill base and we do the skill base. Now, a lot of this is in with trade and industry, but nevertheless, I would be interested to know what are the threads that hold us together. I thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, honourable members. Any other contribution? Okay. Can I just raise perhaps two questions? The one is the issue of the FTAs. Now, we have difficulties in consolidating our own SADC FTA. We are pursuing on a twin track the TFTA, the tripartite, you know, FTA. Now, with all the inherent contradictions amongst ourselves, first as a region, but also, of course, those that will emerge with through the negotiations in this process. Doesn't it pose a dilemma for us, first, because the negotiations are also taking place at the level of the regional secretariats over and above the member states themselves. Now, SADC as a region, you, for instance, highlighted that there's about six FTA regimes operating at the same time with their own inherent, you know, contradictions, if you wish. Is there a way in which we are going to what's the trajectory, you know, going forward in resolving these, and in some instances, these fundamental contradictions, you know, arising out of these issues. That's one. Two is the matter of the EPAs, of the EPAs, have been on the table for quite some time. And there simply doesn't seem to be an end in sight in terms of resolving these issues. Now, my understanding is sometime last year, there were a number of, you know, sister countries who've initialed. Now, our understanding of initial is an intent to fight. Now, my understanding is since some have fight. So, again, that exacerbates already untenable situation. And of course, there is legally these countries have obligations now, you know, both in terms of their domestic and international law, you know, to keep to these agreements with the European Union, whatever the terms are, and whether or not then they are favorable or not, because the becomes a non-issue because, you know, there are obligations now. So, again, what's the trajectory? Is there an end in sight? You know, in 2 years' time, 3 years' time, perhaps until the expiry of this FTA or renegotiation you know, of this FTAs. But is there a, you know, do we know from here we will have this matter resolved? I mean, there are clear deadlines in terms of with the tripartite FTA. There are clear deadlines, you know, in 3 years' time, this is phase one, 6 to 12 month negotiations. 3 years, this is what we want, you know, this is where we want to be. But with the resolving this issue around the airport, is there such a... And then the last one is the revenue sharing formula. Look, needless to say, that, you know, SACU, with all the pomp and fanfare, you know, that accompanied the centenary celebrations. Now I'm actually becoming jealous a bit, Mukhalap, because it's slightly older than the African National Congress. When in fact it is not such a progressive tool, a progressive instrument, you know. Because really, you know, in the final, I mean, all of us can agree really that, you know, these the revenues taken out of SACU by our partners, in fact, you know, in some instances, finance the repression of our people in these countries. But these pay for the extravagant lifestyles, you know, of the King Mswatis, as opposed to the Swazi people benefiting, you know, directly from these. Now, you see, no, it's not the first time the ANC have been saying these things. The ANC has been very clear about these things. You know, what I'm actually saying is what the ANC has said. No, I'm just saying that it's not new. That's what I'm saying. So I'm saying, but is there a way, you know, going forward, that we'll be able to use this instrument to curb some of these excesses? You know? With the review that you were talking about, or in the context of the review that you were talking about, you know, is there a way? Yeah, I think those are for now my questions. Thank you. Yes, please.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. Let's start with the EPAS. I think that from the South African side, we have always opposed the EPAS. One, because we thought that they were not a good movement for the continent, that if not careful, they were going to exacerbate our problems rather than help us solve our problems. And I think one of the things that we have said, and I think that the members here have been saying that one of our key policies of or key focus of our foreign policy is integration. And one of the reasons why we didn't want the EPAS is because we thought that, one, they were not helping us deal with the problems that we're encountering at the World Trade Organization Doha round. That is it. Secondly, they were not going to help us in terms of achieving our objectives of attaining regional integration. So they were actually going to make the situation worse. But what we were rather doing is we were opening the market for their goods and not really getting them to open up the market for our goods. So that was where we started off. I think that what South Africa did is that at a bilateral level, in our engagement with various countries, we tried to draw their attention to those issues. But probably the work was not sufficient. We tried to raise that at a SADC level. We tried to raise that at an AU level. However, you know, Chairperson, we must also acknowledge the fact that somebody mentioned that friendship. You know, we've always talked about countries that have supported us in our struggle. We've always spoken about frontline states. But in as much as we talk to them, the European Union also comes after we had gone and try to convince them. And somehow, most of the African countries, one, because of the sizes of the countries themselves, and then two, because of the sizes of their economies, they then feel that if they are put under pressure by the European Union and they don't agree to some of the things, one, they are not going to get aid. And the fact of the matter as well is that some of the countries, 70% of their government budgets are paid by these countries.
Yeah.
So if they are going to take a different route, what does that mean for them as a country and their existence? And we know that when this aid comes, it comes with strings attached. So when they weigh things, we are the ones that get sacrificed. So I think that there needs to be much more that we do. And I think that not only did we speak to other fellow African countries, we spoke to the European Union and said it's not in your interest for these EPAs to be signed. And now where we are at, Chairperson, is that the European Union said we need to review these EPAs, basically meaning that they need to be renegotiated. And I think this is a window of opportunity opening up for us to actually put in more work and see how we can move forward in terms of dealing with these ones. Now, I think it was Ms. Jacobus who was raising the issue that we are expected to, I think it's Mukhalapa who was mentioning that when whatever we do, we must practice good governance and good corporate governance. I think that we don't need to hear that from the Western countries, because each time they come, they say, you must practice good governance, good corporate governance. We have a lot of instruments, both at a regional and at a continental level, protocols that talk to good governance, protocols that talk to corporate governance, that we have signed and acceded to as number of countries. And I think a good example that one can give is the African peer review mechanism. Now, the African peer review mechanism is not intended to be punitive, but to be corrective. For instance, to say that, okay, we think Kenya is weak when it comes to corporate governance. How do we then, as a continent, assist Kenya to overcome the problems of not being good in corporate governance? That's just an example that I'm given. And the very same Western countries that will tell us that we need to practice good governance, we need to adhere to human rights, it's a given. Those are values that are enshrined in our constitution. But the same countries, they'll say, don't go and trade with China because they violate human rights. And immediately they are installed in power, they run to China and sign agreements with China and tell us that we shouldn't sign those agreements with China. But that is the uneven world in which we find ourselves operating in. Now, in terms of Kwaku Chairperson, the question that you've asked about revenue sharing formula. From South Africa, we put more in the kitty than we get out. So in a way, it's like you are basically giving aid to all these countries. Exactly. And what now happens is that we are proposing to say whatever money we make from SACU, why don't we create a development fund? Which fund will assist us, one, in putting up infrastructure, but which fund will actually assist us to do intra-SACU trade? Now, Chairperson, the reality of the matter is that whether it's Swaziland, it's Botswana, it's Namibia, it's Lesotho, all these countries use the revenue from SACU as part of their national budget. Now, we have a choice to make. And the choice is, if at a decision-making level, one of the things that we need to review, we say that we must take unified decisions. Is it realistic for us, South Africa, a population of almost 50 million people with the size of the economy we have, to take the same economic decisions as a country like Swaziland or Lesotho? Now, we think it's not possible. But then if we then say, let's all of us take our own individual economic decisions based on what our needs are, then it means that we are no longer a customs union. We are now going to revert to being a free trade area. But also, if we review the revenue, they've done a study. Now, in terms of what South Africa puts in the kitty, we should make about 70%. We should get 70% out of that. Then countries like Lesotho and Swaziland are going to lose out. But again, if we review that formula, the reality at a political level is that, one, a country like Namibia and Botswana, they will have to review their macroeconomic policies. And then a country like Swaziland and Lesotho, once we review the formula, we must live with the fact that you are going to have two failed states. Now, we also have problems of whether a country like Swaziland is a democracy or not. The choice we have to make is, do we leave it to collapse and then pop up a new government that will be democratic, or we want to support them, even though we know that they are not a democratic country. Those are the choices we have to make. And I think that's where we come in as DILCO, looking at the political aspect of it. However, all these issues of SACU, the revenue sharing, the unified decision-making processes, and all those ones, they are driven by the Department of Trade and Industry. But for us, we are there to say that should we review the formula, these are the consequences that we're going to have, that two of the countries are going to be failed states, and two of them will literally have to start from scratch, re-looking at their macroeconomic policies. Now, in terms of the threats that cut across, I think that the fact that in comparison to the other eight regs on the continent, I think that South Africa, SADC is at the top of all of them in terms of what we are doing. And of course, we have what we call special development initiatives that has tried to link one way or the other. Because, for instance, if you are a business person based in Johannesburg and you are doing business with a Mozambican company, you can literally sit on a freeway. It will take you right into Maputo. And we have been able to do a number of those ones. But we are saying that there is still much more room for us to improve on those ones. And then I think that as well, in terms of accountability, we can say a large number of the SADC countries are doing very well in terms of accounting. And then we also have one thing or the other that we are producing, and therefore we need to just make sure that we diversify our product and make ourselves globally competitive. Yes, I do agree with the issue that maybe we may have to have public hearings, and I think that we have given the presentation, but it may also be very helpful that you get the same maybe from a DTI point of view, because then they go into more technical issues in terms of dealing with these issues. Now, it becomes very difficult to deal with the issue of movement of goods, people, and services. And that's why at a tripartite level, it is felt that it's one of those areas that we need to give priority. It is not going to be possible for us to do business when we are going to stifle the movement of goods, people, and services. Of course, goods, there will always be those ones that dump. Actually, we call it dumping, that those ones that dump. But we need to be ready and see how we deal with that. Within the WTO, there are rules in terms of how you deal with the issues of dumping. And then also at a Home Affairs level and at a SADC level, we have the ministers that deal with security that are looking at what we call UniVisa, which will actually enhance the free movement of people. But this one, the UniVisa, is much broader than the region. But to say how do we even attract tourists from other parts of the world that will enter the SADC region, where you enter, you then don't need the visas to go to other countries. And we see how we impose a tourism tax that can translate into something if you look at the actual numbers of tourists that come to the SADC region. Human development, I think it is a fact. Whatever we do, that's why in any country, we say that if there are people who come from outside and want to invest, it's not going to help us to bring a cleaner, a CEO, an engineer, everybody from your country. Then what is it that you are leaving for the country where you are going? Therefore, skills development is very key, but then it also helps us with a job creation. It doesn't mean that we are not going to look at the issue of the skills development, but we thought that those ones are the starting point. Of course, whatever we do, we are going to actually be looking at that. And I think that we are already looking at skills development in our collaboration with the various partners, whether it is with the Chinese or the Japanese. And I think the Japanese are very good in terms of soft skills development, as in the teachers, your nurses, and all those. And so those are some of the things that we are looking at. I think I've actually, some of them, I think they were just really observations, but in terms of the ones that needed response, I think I've been able to cover that, unless my colleague has something to add.
Yeah, thank you so much, DDG. Honorable members, I think she should, I get that sense. Suffice it to say, I just want to comment on two issues, but those are just remarks. One is my extreme trepidation at the issue of funding of SETC programs by foreign donors. You see, Ambassador, we have seen this thing in action, or we are seeing it in action at the level of the African Union. And it's a matter of grave concern. Because when we said that, you know, we want to reform the OAU from the OAU to the AU, we were saying that is part of the broader African agenda for Africa to extricate itself, you know, from where it is to more self-reliance and engagement with the world on the basis of being equals and so on and so on. Now, this grand vision set out by our leaders, you know, way back, long before the Tawombekis and the Obasanjos, you know, the Amilcar Cabral, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and so you can go into it, is seriously undermined by the role of especially European capital or money pumped into the African Union, especially by the European Union, and the amount of leverage and influence that grants them in shaping, you know, and influencing Africa's agenda. It will be a sad day when we see that duplicating itself in the context of SADC. SADC must find a way. Of course, you are able to contain that kind of thing, you know, through what you said earlier, you know, looking at directing it to programs that are more, if you wish, peripheral. But the point really is this is brought about, as you said, by members not contributing what they should have been contributing, and somehow it's a matter that we need to, you know, as a region, address and seriously address, because that will certainly, you know, undermine all our efforts at regional integration and so on and so on. I'm really personally, you know, I'm concerned about it. I'm really concerned about it. Honourable members, I would suggest perhaps for future, for a future engagement on this aspect, perhaps both at the level of the region and the level of the AU, to really look into the and quantify this influence, you know. Quantify this influence and say what is it and really look into it as members of parliament. Secondly, but all these issues, comrades, honorable members, point to the centrality of parliamentary diplomacy. Because my view is, you know, if by now some of our counterparts in other countries haven't assented to or ratified, you know, some of these I am sure some of this could have been unlocked by through parliamentary diplomacy.
Yeah.
You know, it could, yes, you know, it, or even party to party engagements and so on. But some diplomacy outside of the normal channels, you know, and I'm just emphasizing it, and perhaps for our own consumption as a committee, that there's a lot of opportunities for parliamentary diplomacy to be strengthened around some of these areas without treading into what is traditionally the role of diplomacy between two countries, traditional diplomacy as we know it. So thank you so much, Ambassador, for the presentation. Shall we go to the next?
I just wanted to say, Chairperson, you know, South Africa has already reached its limits in terms of what we pay at SADC level, and our contribution is $6 million per annum. And normally, even when you ask questions, I think that it's for the entire SADC to be concerned about its well-being. Because even if a country pays 100,000, it could have used that 100,000 for whatever it needs in its own country. Because whether it is at a SADC level and at the AU level, our membership contribution is GDP based. I can tell you that at SADC level last year, Angola's own went up by 68% because they had the highest GDP. And ours went up by 17%, and that 17% translated to almost $900,000. But the biggest worry is also the sustainability of that. You know, how often can we sustain that? At the AU level, we pay $20 million, and it's five countries that pay $20 million on their own. It's South Africa, it's Egypt, it's Libya, it's Algeria, it's Nigeria. Now, already the other countries are saying that this is not going to be sustainable. So if even two of the five countries say that we cannot pay the $20 million, what then happens to the entire project of that? But I think that we also need to look at how we do business, because the larger part of the budget go to emoluments. It's the traveling, it's the S&Ts, it's everything, you know, and we've been complaining we cannot have African civil servants being paid S&T at a UN plus 20 when everybody is implementing austerity measures given the difficult times that we are finding. But somehow with the other countries, they feel that, okay, those ones who pay more must be the ones who complain, who say everything, but I think that's besides the point. If you pay 10 rand or 100 rand, you could have used your 10 rand for something else at home. If you pay 100 rands, you could have used it for something else at home. All of us have our own challenges in our countries. And I think that because of also the high rate of default, that's why we are not able to deliver on some of our programs, because few countries pay and some don't pay. Okay, Chairperson, diaspora. Well, with the diaspora, the presentation, we are seeking to provide the portfolio committee with an update on South Africa's hosting of the AU Summit on the African Diaspora, but also to share with the portfolio committee the outcomes of the technical committee experts meeting. Let me also start by saying, Chairperson, that when the diaspora issue was started, it was trying to state that at the center of the African diaspora is the epicenter of the discourse around the search for strategies to decisively deal with the problems of poverty, underdevelopment, and marginalization of the African continent. But also it was with the understanding that when you look at the monies that come into the continent from the diaspora, I think some 2 years ago it was exceeding $1 billion. So it did show that there is quite a lot of money that comes into the continent through the remittances. But to say, how do we then utilize the skills that the diaspora has out there and how can we bring them on board to be able to contribute to the developmental agenda of the African continent. And the second AU Assembly recognized the importance of the African diaspora as a tool that is needed in building and strengthening the African Union, but also in dealing with the problems that I just alluded to. The summit also expressed its desire for the African diaspora to be institutionalized as the sixth region of the African Union. Now, Chairperson, when we talk about the diaspora, there are different levels of the diaspora. They are those ones who see themselves as the genuine diaspora because they say we were taken from the African continent as slaves and we have lost our roots, so we think that we should be the diaspora. Then they are those ones who are classified as a what would, for lack of a better word, economic diaspora, those who move from the African continent and go outside to look for better, greener pastures to improve their own economic environment. But also, I think for the African diaspora, for the African government, it means that we lose the skills that the African government would have actually created using their meager budget. So those are some of the challenges we have. Now, when we talk about the sixth region, we also have the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. How do we bring them on board? Do we mean if we say they are the sixth region, they will participate in all the AU business, or we will call on them as and when we need them? So I must say that from the onset, that the issue of what we mean by the sixth region is something that we have not been able to thoroughly flesh out. So it still is one of those issues that we need to revisit. But again, I guess that at the end of the day, a political decision will need to be taken in terms of what is it that we mean when we talk about the sixth region, African diaspora being the sixth region. Also, the AU mandated South Africa to host the African Diaspora Summit during 2006. The executive during the 2006 Executive Council meeting that was held in Khartoum. Let me say that a lot of work has been done with regards to the diaspora. Now, when we held the TCAM, which is the technical experts meeting, we were just trying to tighten up the project that we had agreed on, but to see whether there had been any development since 2006. That would necessitate us to update whatever documentation we have around the issues of the diaspora. So when we were supposed to actually hold the diaspora summit in 2008, but because of lack of financial resources, South Africa had to craft a new roadmap for the hosting of the summit in 2012. And we have elaborated on the roadmap during the July summit, where we were saying that we will host the diaspora summit in July. And we are going to be hosting the ministerial probably 2 or 3 days before we go to the General Assembly. And we are going to be hosting the ministerial in New York. I'll come to that issue a little bit later, Chairperson. South Africa has formally proposed that the African diaspora be a standing item at the AU summit leading up to the 2012 African diaspora that we will host. The objective being to ensure proper coordination and endorsement for South Africa's central role in articulating both content and logistical planning for the summit. Africa Multilateral, which is the branch that we belong to, has always been seized with the responsibilities of ensuring a successful implementation of the roadmap of the diaspora. The process itself is intended to foster a coordinated and unified approach, as well as to solicit a buy-in and cooperation amongst all stakeholders. As we had mentioned, it's all the 53 African countries, the Caribbean and the Pacific countries, and also making sure that politically we've got a buy-in. Now, the modus operandi is really based on the engagement and participation of internal, regional, and external stakeholders. This is to ensure that all role players, be it parliament, civil society, and all of government, is seized with a continuous, with us continuously briefing them and debriefing them as well on all the issues. Chairperson, you see that additional to Africa Multilateral being the focal point, the following missions have been identified as key in dealing with the issue of African diaspora. And these are targeted primarily for us to carry out diaspora consultations, which we are planning before the ministerial takes place. And you will see there that we have listed the countries in Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America, Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, and also in North America. And these countries will be key in us revamping the regional coordinating committees that we have in all these countries. And we use the regional coordinating committees to actually push the positions that we think we should be taking as we move forward towards the summit of the diaspora. Certain capitals above regions will be visited and ensure that they are on the ground structures so that there is a sustainable form of engagement. Thus far, we have covered North America, preparatory meetings, and assured South Africa's hosting of and support of the Congressional Black Caucus and some of those individuals, and the World Bank has also agreed to come on board in terms of the funding. Now, the approach that we have taken with regard to the African diaspora is threefold. We thought that we need to look at political cooperation, economic cooperation, and social cooperation. Now, what we have done is that under each one of these subheadings, we thought that it's important that we come up with a specific project that we will look at. Now, under political, we need to look at the urgent ratification of the protocol of amendment to the Constitutive Act that enables effective participation of the African diaspora in the affairs of the African Union. Secondly, we need to have enhanced opportunities for diaspora participation in the African Union affairs. We need also to have facilitation of diaspora inclusion in AU structures and processes. And then we need to also look at targeting the needs of the diaspora. So as you can see, Chairperson, under political, there are specific things that we need to do. We want that as and when the African Union takes decisions, they must be able to filter into the diaspora. And to that extent, we have agreed that we need to have formal institutions created for us to be able to link up with the diaspora. Of course, they are there, but some of them, we don't know them. So they are going to be coming back to the AU and telling us which of the structures have they been formalized, so that when we communicate with them. And then if also we embark on specific projects, then the feedback can come back to us through those structures. On economic cooperation, we agreed that there needs to be government action to develop integration mechanisms. As you remember, Chairperson, I was talking that the remittances from the diaspora exceed $1 billion US dollars. So now we need to have a proper structure of how we can coordinate this, because we think right now it's done really in a manner that is not properly coordinated. Mobilization of capital to ensure sustained economic cooperation and between government and business entities in Africa and the diaspora. For instance, we think that we need to, even in terms of research and development, we can utilize some of the skills that our diaspora has outside there and see how we can deal with that. And right now, not so long ago, the U.S. government has passed an Africa diaspora investment bill. Basically, the U.S. government wants to utilize the bill to strengthen its relations with the African continent. Now we will need to have strong diaspora that is on the ground in the U.S. to make sure that the U.S. government is held accountable in terms of what it's supposed to do under that investment bill. We need to look at the building of business linkages to associate the African diaspora to the processes of social and economic development, the usage of science and technology, prioritization of knowledge transfer and skills mobilization, infrastructure development, information gathering and dissemination capacity, and also the issues of climate change. We think that these are some of the issues and concrete projects that we can be doing with our diaspora as they are outside the continent. In terms of social cooperation, we thought that we need to focus more on knowledge and education, coordinated protection of indigenous knowledge systems to promote innovation, the area of arts and culture, media outlets. For instance, around media, we thought that most of the people still talk about Africa as a dark continent, that there is a lot of Afro-pessimism going around. And then we thought that with some of the media that the diaspora has access to, we can begin to embark on a project that will focus on positive projection of the African continent, in other words, Afro-optimism project. And then the other one is more about human and people's rights migration. And one of the other projects that we omitted to add there is that the African Union declared 2010-2020 as a decade of women. And then we thought that we need to engage the women in the diaspora and see what is it that we will do with them in realizing the decade of women as per the summit decision of 2010. Now, I had mentioned earlier on that we are going to be hosting a ministerial conference in September. The ministerial conference will consider the policy recommendations coming out of the experts meeting for the summit's adoption, as well as finalize the summit declaration. It is also proposed that the ministerial be hosted in New York on the margins of UNGA. Chairperson, let me state that when we host these meetings, we have to pay for the tickets, for accommodation, for the meals, and the S&T. So we thought that because all the ministers that we'll be targeting will be going to New York to attend the General Assembly, that it will be good to do it there. But the major reason why we thought that it will be good to host the ministerial in New York is because the Secretary General of the UN has declared 2011 the year of solidarity with people of African descent. So we thought it would be appropriate to actually do the ministerial in New York in celebrating the declaration also by the Secretary General. But it will also help us to ensure better attendance of ministers in the AU, Caribbean, and Latin America. It is going to go a long way in terms of mediating the host country costs. It will provide prominence and elevation of the African diaspora discourse within issues of global significance. It will also ensure a positive public projection of the African diaspora, as well as assisting us synergize with the UN Declaration on 2011 being a year of peoples of African descent. Now, in terms of the summit, politically we have a decision that has already been taken that we need to host the diaspora summit to coincide with May 25. But also, Chairperson, 2012 will also not only be the year where we host only the diaspora, it will be the centenary of the ruling party, but also we will be celebrating the decade of the launch of the African Union. So 2012 is going to be a significant year, very busy one for that matter, and then we thought that there would not be a better time for us to do the summit, if not on the 25th of May. The objectives of the summit, Chairperson, it will be to adopt an African diaspora summit declaration, as well as the program of action, and then also to launch the agreed project, which will be accompanied by the time frame. Africa Multilateral seeks the support of Parliament, but to carry you with us in terms of understanding what it is that we want to achieve by going into the ministerial meeting as well as the summit. DIRCO will continuously advise and inform Parliament of processes and developments leading up to the hosting of the summit next year, and we also intend to ensure a greater South African engagement and awareness on the issue of the African diaspora and its importance towards the developmental agenda on the continent. As you can see, on Mr. Mokgalapa is very fond of the issues of public diplomacy. So I think that aspect really talks about the role we will be playing as DIRCO in public diplomacy to make sure that we carry ordinary South Africans in with us in understanding what the African diaspora is all about. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Ambassador, for your comprehensive presentation. Honorable members, there it is, I think, all around good news. We've been waiting for this diaspora summit for the better part of what? Since 2008, I think? 2007? 2006. Yes. Okay, so now we even have dates. You know, we've advanced to dates.
A roadmap,
hopefully, which will be duplicated in Libya. Honorable members, any questions, clarity, seeking responses? None.
I think it's crystal clear. It's crystal clear, Chair. And I think the Ambassador has summed it well when he included public diplomacy at the end. I think that's the most key one.
Yes.
Because of as it's in our shores, we got to make sure that we go on a roadshow to make our people understand what will be the benefits of us hosting this diaspora and what is it in general, this diaspora. But I hope it's not a debate, this issue of who is the diaspora. Is it the slaves or is it the people in economic migrants? I hope it doesn't derail the purpose of a diaspora in general. It's just something that's happening outside the country. How intense is that debate in terms of moving forward on who is a diaspora? I hope it's just an academic debate, not a mainstream debate. But overall, I think public diplomacy is the way to go in making sure that we spread the gospel. Thanks, Chair.
Ambassador?
No, I don't think that it's so much of a debate. I think the only thing that also the diaspora wants from us, they say they want to come back home. Now, it's very difficult to know which one is home when we have 53 countries and they want the African passport, which we don't have even at the AU level right now. But I guess that when the time comes, we'll be able to deal with those challenges. Thank you.
And of course, those are some of the issues that hopefully will be raised and dealt with at the summit. Okay. Now, honorable members, I thank you so much, Ambassador, on this one. Perhaps at some point we must talk about what support are you talking about? Define the kind of support that you require. What role you see as a department, Parliament can play in support of this process. But we'll come to that at a later stage. Okay, honourable members. Then the last one on the agenda is the candidatures. Ambassador, please, honourable members. Perhaps just for the benefit of honourable Druhan, who has just arrived. Thank you, honourable Druhan. We have received your apology. I didn't because it came. Whilst we were in the course of the meeting, I couldn't notify the honourable members, but the apology, honourable members, was that she would be late because she still attended communications, the other portfolio committee. Thank you for joining us, honourable member. Honorable Member, on the issue of the candidatures, I have made announcements earlier that in her presentation, the ambassador will not delve into the specifics of names of candidates to international organizations and positions and so on, because of the sensitive nature of negotiations around these issues. And of course, the issues of, this is a public meeting, so this information will naturally, you know, go out in public, which is not desirable, especially because of the sensitivities around negotiations around candidates between countries and so on. However, she will give us a broad outline of South Africa's approach to filling these positions, or candidatures in international organizations broadly, so that we understand that. We have received a document which has some specifics with regard to countries that are lobbying us for positions in what organizations, who we are lobbying for what positions and on the basis of what names. But that document, Honorable Member, is for your own consumption. It is a confidential document that may not be discussed outside of this meeting or inside of this meeting as well. Okay. Just for your benefit, Honorable Members, thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to be very brief on this one. Here, I'm just trying to outline the process of how we constitute the committee within the department to look at the candidates at multilateral organizations. One, we have formally constituted a committee on the candidates, and the responsibility of that committee is really to coordinate and synchronize system-wide activities, recommendations and motivations for support, non-support of candidates for positions in international organizations as provided to the departmental principals for decision. I must say that what normally happens is that the committee will be chaired by a chief director, which is the least rank that we look at, and you will have chief directors and directors coming from various branches, whether it be multilateral or bilateral, and the business units will then present to the committee whatever request they have received for support, and we will then look at all the invitations that we get. Normally, when we decide to support one, some of the countries will come to you and ask for support and promise to also support us in return for whatever positions that we want. Some of them, we will support them based on regional representation and also on gender parity. We like to look at all those issues. And on the basis of that, we will then decide which are the countries that we want to support. I must say that also at the UN level, normally if it is African candidates, we always feel they are always required that they are candidates be actually endorsed by the African Union before they go to the UN. If they have not been endorsed by the African Union, then we do not allow those candidates to be forwarded to the UN. The reason being that it doesn't matter which African country is there, but whenever they are there, they are all there representing the issue, the interests of the African continent. So that is basically how we deal with it. Let me also mention, Chairperson, that we have a secondment policy that has been developed by the Department of Public Service and Administration. However, what we have been doing as well at DILCO is to see whether we can come up with a document to augment that. I will give you, for instance, an example. Right now, there is a position of an AU ambassador to the EU. And when we received the package, we saw that they don't give pension. They also don't give medical aid. Now all our diplomats, when they go outside, they must be covered in terms of medical aid. But also you don't want to disadvantage any person by going there, because they are going to lose their contribution towards the pension. We need to make it very attractive. I think that from the DIRCO point of view, we have generated a letter signed by our minister to all her counterparts, asking them to forward us the names of their employees that they think we should keep in our database, so that as and when the positions become available, we can be able to deploy the South Africans. Because, Chairperson, the reality of the matter is that we cannot drive a global agenda without being there. Because sometimes when you are in there, you get to know what is happening, what positions are taken, particularly on the African continent. I think it's very important to do that. Now, one of the biggest challenges we have, I think a good example that one can give is Advocate Zweletu Madasa, who came from Parliament, who's gone to the Pan-African Parliament, that we need to augment the salaries of our people in order to make the multilateral organizations attractive. Now, always the impression is created that when DIRCO identify the possibilities, that we will have to augment. But the salaries that we receive are the salaries that we receive as per the size of the post-establishment in the department. We don't have extra, you know, to pay for the others. So we think that maybe between this portfolio committee and the finance one, we need to look at how, whether it be a treasury, to create a kitty where we will have the money, so that in the event where we need to augment, that can be done. And because of that, we always find it very difficult to get South Africans to go there, because what we pay at home and what is paid outside, sometimes there is a discrepancy. And if we are not able to augment, we are not going to be able to attract the best South Africans there. And I think we want to emphasize that we need the best, because they go there, they paint a good picture about South Africa, it becomes easy in future to deploy more South Africans there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Ambassador. Let me take the first bite on this one. Is this somebody like to make this comparison of, in fact, using this analogy of punching above our weight? And so there was this talk about, but somebody said, no, we are not punching above our weight. We are punching within our weight. But for us to do so, if we really want to have that influence, you know, if we want to play at that level, we must be prepared to spend at that level. So it's something that the committee has been quite passionate about. Our, you know, candidatures to international organizations and positions that we seem not to take up, it's a matter that has been really uppermost in the minds of the honorable members. And it's a matter that we will continue to monitor. I have said in the budget vote, in my budget vote speech, that it's one matter that we will continuously monitor in addition to all the others. It looks like there is hope going forward. At least the department now is clear about, you know, how you approach the thing going forward, and in fact what role we can play as a parliamentary portfolio committee. In terms of leveraging the necessary resources, especially in the context of a shrinking budget of the department, over the past, what is it, about three financial years or so, that your budget has been shrinking. Yes. So these are some of the issues that we might also have to, engage on this thing more broadly as a committee. And consider the proposal that we perhaps one of the things to do is to engage the finance committee in appropriations around these issues broadly. But, honorable members, I'm throwing it open to you. Looks like you've said it all, Ambassador.
I said it back, it's bringing a solid issue for the committee. So we are happy with the status quo, with the report that is being given, and that the department is actively working on the core principal issue, because of we've had the reason why South Africans don't want to take up these positions is because of the remuneration part of it. So if we are working hard on that one. But I find it strange that most of the Africans take these positions. I guess maybe it's a question of relative economies. It's better than that. So we got to work hard in doing that, because of if we talk about reform of this institution, the only reform is for us to come in into those institutions. So I agree fully with you, Ambassador, that what we need to do is if we want to transform, if we want to make influence into this global multilateral, we got to swell them. That's the only way. Thanks, Chair.
Oh, okay. Yes, Honorable Rohan.
If I may respond to...
Ambassador, just before you... Yeah.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm still very new in this committee, so I am learning. So I just want to ask, can you list all the international organizations, back then the AU and all that that you've been saying, but does that include WHO, UNICEF, all those organizations, does it include the International Human Rights Court, those, I mean, you're talking about all those organizations, all of those international organizations. You can send that list maybe to the secretary and she can then just, you know, give it to members. Thanks.
Can I just, before you respond, Ambassador,
Okay, fine, continue. I just can't recall now.
Okay, Chairperson, I'll give her my copy, because there I think that we have the candidates that are coming up now. We can provide to the portfolio committee the list of South Africans that we have already in these positions. But I thought that maybe in responding to what Mr. Makgalapa said, that South Africa's public service pays very good salary in comparison to the other countries. So I think then that's why sometimes it's not that I want to limit the possibility of an increase. So it becomes very difficult for us to be attracted to these positions. But also what we have seen is that in most of these positions you find former ministers. Countries field their former ministers. Now, when you look at what our former ministers are doing, they are writing books, they are speaking, they get paid, and sometimes they feel less attracted to these positions. But some of them are there, but we don't have many of them. We have approached quite a few, they agreed, and when they are supposed to go, then they backtrack. So we are not so sure what the problem is. But one of the other problems we have also discovered is that some of our people go to these institutions, let's say for 4-8 years. They come back, then they find that the departments didn't reserve their positions for them. So one, they go to the private sector, but we also lose the experience that they are bringing with them back into the country. So we actually didn't have a proper system of ensuring that when these people come back, then we are able to actually absorb them back into the system and utilize them, or even to say that when you complete, because we have deployed you there, at least we want you to be working for government for the next 2-3 years before you can leave. So I think that the onus is both ways. One, to actually make sure that we make these attractive, but also as they go out there, they should know what their responsibilities towards the government is. And then I think that way at least we make sure that we are able to retain the skills that we have been able to build in all these years. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for that comprehensive very, very comprehensive presentation. We thank you so much. Honorable members, that has brought us to the end of our meeting. We'll see each other again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.